Okay, as we explored in the first shiur of the fifth parak of Avot, the whole fifth parak revolves around numbers. At least that seems to be the, it certainly is, the primary common link to all of the Mishnayot, almost all of the Mishnayot in the parak, is that there, and the organizational principle around which the parak is structured is one of lists of different things, we'll categorize those things in a moment, but lists that have specific numbers of items. As we said last time, the first several Mishnayot in the fifth parak, it's very clear, revolve around the number 10. And last time we spent some time trying to explore if there is something more than just the number that happens to be, here are 10 things, here are 10 things about this, here are 10 things about that, something a little bit more, more meaningful, more, let's say stronger, that links together all of the Mishnayot in this list. The last time we suggested that whereas the parak begins with the list, not the list, but the mention that the world was created with 10 utterances, with 10 declarations. So everything that follows from that, everything follows from that essentially. The Mishnah says, those who uphold those 10 utterances, then those who fulfill the purpose of the world are fulfilling a purpose of the world that was created with 10 utterances. In other words, these 10 utterances are the basis of the existence of the world. Someone who supports God's purpose in the world is supporting, they're putting their weight behind 10 utterances, which is substantial. And somebody who is opposing the world is not just opposing one utterance of God, but really opposing 10 utterances of God. And then in the subsequent Mishnayot, so we explored the possibility that perhaps really everything is an outgrowth of those first 10 utterances. That Avraham, in upholding the world at the end of the 10 generations from Noach till Avraham, Avraham earned the reward of those who uphold the 10 utterances. And beyond that, there are consequences, or perhaps we should say rewards, benefits, that Avraham reaps for himself and then bequeaths to his children after him in terms of those 10 merits that he has, having passed the 10 trials, and in so doing, upholding the 10 utterances with which the world was created. Okay, that was a string that really ran through, at least it seems to be, runs through the first several Mishnayot in the parak. And at the end of the list of 10, so the Mishnah goes on to the next number, which is 7, and that's where we will start today. Of course, in front of us today will be the challenge to first understand the Mishnayot that are in front of us as individual units, and if possible, to make sense of what the connection is between the Mishnayot and what this says about the overarching theme of the parak, which admittedly will be a rather challenging task for us today, but we'll see at least what we can say and hopefully have some food for thought. So the Mishnah Zayin says the following: Shiv'a dvarim begolem v'shiv'a bechacham. Chacham, number one, eino medaber bifnei mi shehu gadol mimenu bechochma. Ve'eino nichnas, number two, ve'eino nichnas l'toch divrei chaviro. Number three, ve'eino nivhal lehashiv. Number four, shoel ka'inyan u'meshiv kehalacha. Number five, ve'omer al rishon rishon. Ve'al acharon acharon. Number six, ve'al ma shelo shama omer lo shama'ati u'mode al ha'emet. That's number seven. V'chilufehen bigolem. There are seven behaviors that may be found with or among a golem. Seven behaviors characterize a golem, and seven characterize a wise person. Okay, now the definition of a chacham is a little bit more complicated than a wise person. We'll come back to that momentarily. But for our purposes, we can say a wise person. Okay, seven behaviors characterize a golem, and seven characterize a wise person. The wise person is characterized by these. He doesn't speak before someone who's greater than he is in wisdom. He doesn't interrupt his friend's speech. He doesn't answer things hastily. That was the third one. Number four, he asks appropriate questions and gives proper, let's say, relevant or applicable answers. They'll really shoel ka'inyan u meshiv kahalacha, even though they have different words, ka'inyan and kahalacha. Basically, at least for our purposes today, we can simply say he asks appropriate questions and answers appropriately. Okay. Number five, it says about the first thing that it's first and the last thing that it's last. We'll have to come back to that as well. Number six, concerning something that he hasn't heard, he says he hasn't heard it. And number seven, he concedes the truth. The Mishnah itemizes the seven characteristics or the seven behaviors that characterize the wise person, and the Mishnah finishes by saying, and the opposite is true of the golem. And just a noteworthy pedagogic point over here, that even though the Mishnah began with seven things that characterize the golem, the Mishnah actually never itemized those seven things. In other words, clearly the Mishnah understands, the Mishnah says explicitly, that really what we're talking about is just seven behaviors, and we're talking about doing them right and doing them wrong. It's either yes or no for all of these seven. It's not like there's really 14 items, that seven of them belong to this one, seven belong to the other. No, there's seven. And if a person conducts himself in those seven respects, has those seven behaviors that they consistently follow, then that person is characterized as a chacham. And if they fail in those seven areas, then they're characterized as a golem. So it's really just seven. The question is, why does the Mishnah start with golem and then just repeat? In other words, the Mishnah had the choice to describe the behaviors appropriately and say this is what characterizes the Chacham, or to say here are the seven failings of a golem. And interestingly, it doesn't say what the seven failings of the golem are. I'll just explain myself a little bit better. If I want to talk about interrupting a person, I could say a person who interrupts is called a golem. Or I could say the person who doesn't interrupt is called the Chacham. Interestingly, even though the Mishnah set us up to expect a list of the bad ways of behaving, it said, here are the seven characteristics, the seven characteristic behaviors of the golem, it doesn't say the golem interrupts his friend. It says the Chacham does not interrupt his friend, and so on and so forth. In other words, for all seven of them, the Mishnah really describes for us what should be done, the proper way to behave, and therefore the attributes of the Chacham, although the Mishnah could have just as easily told us the seven things that one should avoid. Just pedagogically, why is it so that the Mishnah describes the seven positive behaviors instead of the corresponding seven negative behaviors? And the answer would seem to be more or less self-evident, because, of course, we should understand that the Mishnah is trying to show us how to behave. It's more effective, more useful, more constructive for the Mishnah to tell us how we should behave rather than to fill our heads with images of things that we shouldn't do, even if we shouldn't be doing them, and even if the Mishnah says we shouldn't be doing them, right? But once the Mishnah tells us, here are the list of the words that you should not say, okay, for example, Well, then, once you're reading those words, they're in your head, and you'll think of those words, and those are things you're going to be tempted to say, a mode of speech that's inappropriate, as opposed to the Mishnah saying, and here are the 7 ways that a person should speak. In other words, Mishnah is implicitly filling our heads with the good message, and implying only the bad message. This is really, again, quite a critical point, but we don't have time to get into it much more now. But in terms of the way that one should approach teaching others, and really in terms of the way that one should approach training themselves, it's not enough to say, it's not really appropriate to say, don't do the bad thing. If a person is trying to teach a child, so the pasuk says, Sur meira va'asei tov. It's not enough, it's not even really very productive to tell the child, okay, here are the 10 things that you can't do. Don't do this, 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 right? Because when the child hears that, then they don't know what they should do. And in fact, all they're thinking of is, right, let's give some examples. Don't play with fire. Don't touch the hot pot. Don't hit your sister. Don't play ball in the house. So even though the word don't preceded all of those points, but all they're thinking about is fire. Okay, not with the fire. Okay, not hitting my sister. But they're thinking, hitting my sister. No. As opposed to thinking, okay, sing a song, play a game, or read a book, walk a little old lady across the street, those kinds of things. That's the tip of the iceberg, but... it's enough of a digression for now. In any case, that is a method that the Mishnah actually does employ over here, that the Mishnah is stressing or modeling for us, really, those things that should be done as opposed to those that should not be done, even though both of them are implied in the Mishnah. Okay, if we want to understand the basic message of the Mishnah, which of course is a key to this Mishnah and the unit in general, and then the whole Perek, there are two words in the Mishnah that really require, two critical words in the Mishnah that really require our special attention and our primary focus. And those words are Golem and Chacham. Not just the words by themselves, but the relationship between those two things. Clearly, they're set up as contrasts and counterparts. Having one, on the one hand, having one set of behaviors characterizes one as a golem, and having the opposite set of behaviors characterizes one as a chacham. So what is the relationship between these two things, and what is a golem and what is a chacham? Let's start with chacham. Although that is listed second, because that's a term that's already more familiar to us, and that may also help us to understand why this Mishnah is where it is. Because the first 10, not the first 10, excuse me, the first list of Mishnayot, the first unit of Mishnayot in the fifth parak revolves around the number 10. But again, not only does it describe lists of things that have 10, but the Mishnah is really itemizing, for the most part, 10 historical facts. 10 historical facts about this, 10 historical facts about that, or, you know, even where it doesn't do that, history revolves around 10 things. In other words, obviously, it teaches us a lesson, and the first Mishnah teaches us that lesson. And the lesson is, if you support Hashem, ki'ilu, right, if you follow in the protocol that Hashem has set out for you, then you're tapping into the 10, right? So that's the ethical message, is that there's something very powerful about it. But again, to exercise the point, that's really not the right word, to demonstrate this point for us, the Mishnah lists 10 historical facts about the Mikdash. The Mishnah mentions that there were 10 trials that Avraham passed. And again, it's basically a way to look at history. This Mishnah already goes in a very different direction, which is to say, here are specific behaviors that that a person may choose to adhere to or to ignore. Seven appropriate behaviors and seven inappropriate behaviors. Okay, and in that respect, the Mishnah has really changed the direction. What is the Mishnah doing here? What does it have to do with the list of ten? And the answer would seem to be none, nothing. It's not even, you don't even have the magic number ten here. So we really need to explore a little bit more. I mean, again, at the end of the day, at the very minimum, and throughout the parak, you have different numbers. You have 10, you have 7, you have 4, you have 3, then you have some other numbers at the end. So the fact that it has a number may be enough, but the question is that enough, and can we tease out a little bit more? So really in the parak, there are some mishnayot that, as I said, describe what I would call as history, not just history because it's interesting, but history to teach us an ethical lesson, perspective on history perhaps. But more than that, there's another unit, another type of Mishnah in this parak, which is very much like this Mishnah, which says there are, you know, and we'll see it more in the next year, God willing, there are a number of different characteristics that apply to this type of person or this type of scenario. And in other words, the Mishnah is perhaps drawing caricatures or exhibiting different modes of behavior, and the person is supposed to look at the world in front of them and look at the different scenarios and look at different choices that they make and be conscious of, oh, I'm doing the optimal thing, I'm doing something undesirable. In other words, when a person has those behaviors spelled out in front of them, then they can pay a little bit more attention to, oh, how do I fall upon in this scale? How do I measure up to the expectations of the Mishnah? A person doesn't realize that there's something wrong, that there's such a phenomenon as interrupting their friend. Then they may interrupt other people when they speak all the time and not be sensitive to it at all. Once the Mishnah puts it on our radar, you know what? There's something called interrupting your friend. And interrupting your friend makes you a golem. And knowing how not to interrupt your friend makes you a chacham. Once the Mishnah sensitizes us to that, then we can choose the proper mode of behavior. That's a second type of Mishnah. That's a second approach which you have in this parak, which is really unlike, to a great degree, it's unlike at least the unit as a whole, the unit of the tens, which, is, as I said, is more historical. Okay, so this Mishnah fits in that respect, because it demonstrates another significance of numbers. Again, really not necessarily in the same way, and not at all in the same way that the number is used, the number 10 is used, but it's setting up a different model of Mishnayot in the parak, and as I said, there are other Mishnayot that follow this model as well. All of this doesn't help us to translate the word chacham, but it may help a little bit more to understand the placement of the Mishnah, because it's not necessarily only about the seven. Clearly, the most important message of the Mishnah is really, or let's say the topic sentence of the Mishnah, the theme of the Mishnah, is a theme that we visited already several times in Avot and really should be familiar to us, which is, what is Chachma? Or perhaps not necessarily what is Chachma, but tell us something about Chachma. Describe Chachma for us. We have had the question, what is Chacham? What is Chachma? Who is the Chacham? We'll get back to that in just a moment. But also, what are the things that support, fulfill, and concretize Chachma? And that's a very familiar theme to us. The word Chachma and Chacham, those words, that Shoresh, they show up several times over the course of the Masechet. Okay? Now, specifically, we had the first Mishnah of the fourth Perek, which asked the question, Ezehu Chacham Ben Zoma says, Ezehu Chacham HaLomeid Mikol Adam. There were three other questions as well, and that really carried the discussion in the fourth Perek, but perhaps this is another insight into the fourth, into that question of Ezehu Chacham, or perhaps as a slight variation on that theme, what is Chachma? No, I think more appropriately, really, Ezehu Chacham. And it was placed in the fifth parak because of the way that the Mishnah was taught. In other words, this is a Masorah that was structured around the number seven, but thematically it fits in with a theme that's already been on the surface in Avot. And as we said in the fourth parak, surprisingly, the Chacham is not simply defined by, celebrated as one who has read many books, one who solves difficult problems, one who has an exceptional memory, one who solves problems quickly, or any of those things that you might expect, as a knee-jerk kind of definition for a Chacham. No, right? The Mishnah at the beginning of the fourth parak said, "Ezehu Chacham HaLomeid Mikol Adam," which is really more about a posture. It's an attitude towards Chachma, but not just an attitude towards wisdom. It's an attitude towards wisdom which expresses itself in interpersonal behavior, interpersonal relationships, and without it, a person somehow is missing Chachma. I think that this Mishnah really fits in with that theme and that approach very nicely, though it certainly goes further, or you might say just goes into more detail. So if we've already asked the question, if we've already given the answer, let's say, Ezehu Chacham HaLomeid Mikol Adam, then this Mishnah makes a lot of sense. What does it mean to be Lomeid Mikol Adam? What does it mean to be Lomeid Mikol Adam? So first of all, you have to be willing to hear out what your friend has to say and not interrupt. Okay, actually, that was the second attribute listed in our Mishnah. The first behavior was Eino medaber bifnei mishehu gadol mimenu lechochma, that you don't start to speak before someone who's greater than you in wisdom. In other words, even when it's halomeid mikol adam, doesn't necessarily mean you're lomeid 100% from someone who doesn't know so much, in the same way that you would learn from the person who knows a great deal. There's still, right, the Mishnah takes for granted, and not everybody has the same achievement in learning, in wisdom. And therefore, it doesn't make sense to put as much focus in learning from the fool as you do in learning from the wise. We already discussed the Mishnah, Ezehu Chacham HaLomeid Mikol Adam, and should you be trying to learn everything from everyone, it doesn't mean you should be ready, under whatever circumstances, to learn from anyone as opposed to everyone. Those are important questions, but I don't want to digress too much over here. For our purposes, we can say that when you're dealing with another person, so know that you have to deal with the other person and be ready to listen to what they have to say. So that if you recognize that a person has more wisdom than you have, then you may still be called a wise person by according that other person's wisdom the proper respect. I'll give you an example. Since I know that I know very little about Tzara'at, okay? And when somebody comes up to me and asks me a question in Tzara'at, let's say I'm standing with my brother, the Kohen, who has learned the halachas of Nega'im better than I have, and someone comes up to us, since we're Kohanim, and wants to show us a Nega, so I can say, oh, well, I think this and that and the other thing, and just postulate whatever. But since I don't know those halachas very well at all, basically almost not at all, right? So it's foolish of me to start speaking if I know that the person next to me knows them better. And that means that I respect that. Then I'm also called wise because I'm approaching the situation appropriately, and I don't interrupt another person. I don't hastily answer. Okay. Now, some of these clearly don't necessarily have to do with lomet mikol adam in an explicit way. Eino nivhar lehashiv is not really lomet mikol adam, but the overarching, let's say, organizing principle behind these things clearly involves a great deal of knowing one's place and respecting the other. Respecting the other here, it's interesting that these seven behaviors in the Mishnah also relate to, some of them explicitly relate to, answering questions and asking questions, okay? Which is explicit in Shoel Ka'inyan U'meshiv Ka'alacha, but also afterwards, Omer al Rishon Rishon ve'al Acharon Acharon. Number of the commentators over here presume that we're talking about one who's answering questions. The way to sensibly answer questions is to say about the Rishon that it's Rishon, and the Acharon that it's Acharon, which means one of two things. Some of the Mefarshim say it means if the questions were asked in a certain order, you answer them in a certain order because then the answers will be heard and you won't be confusing the questioner. And others say the sequence in which they were asked is actually not of such importance. But when a person answers a question, they have to understand and they should present, let's say, a series of related questions. The answerer should say, you know what? This is the most important thing. Let me first give you the basic principle, the overarching principle, and then get into more peripheral details. Okay, so if a person asks you about a certain food, let's say I have somebody who calls me up sometimes and asks me about hechsherim. So if he asks me about a certain food, I can say, okay, when it comes to this food, you need to, what we need to be aware of, let's say he asks two questions, let me think for one moment. What do you think of, or can I use, can I use a Kiddush cup that had wine with this hechsher on it? Okay, so within that question, there are two questions. One is, what do I think about that hechsher? And the other question is, if a Kiddush cup had that wine in it, does that change the status of the Kiddush cup? Okay. If the wine is in it now, obviously I'm paskening about the, or I'm answering the question with regards to the hechsher itself. If it's not, if the wine is not currently in the cup, then I'm just answering a question about the dish. Does the dish become influenced, treif, etc., having had wine of such and such a hechsher? So what's the most important question here? I have to decide under the circumstances. Is the most important question here halachas of kashrut, including the halacha that if a cold liquid goes into a dish one time and is washed out after the liquid was sitting in the dish for a short period, the dish does not become treif from such a thing, even if it's a treif liquid, under normal circumstances. Is that the most important thing that I should answer, or should I be answering about the hechsher first? And then those are two different issues, and the person answering the question has to decide which one is Rishon and which one is Acharon. Okay, but again, in the end of the Mishnah, you come back to this Al Masha Lo Shama Omer Lo Shamati, which the Mefarshim understand refers to a person who's answering a question or voicing an opinion which may or may not have been influenced by what he's learned from others. In other words, very often when you ask someone a question, you're not just asking them a question, you want to know what they've learned from others. If you ask, let's say, Rav Schechter a question, obviously he has his own opinion on many, many, many things, perhaps everything, and of course everything, but many things
when you'll ask him a question, he'll begin by telling you what his Rebbe said. Okay. Therefore, when you're asking Rav Shechter a question, you may be asking, "What did the Rav say about this? What did Rav Soloveitchik say about this?" But it's up to Rav Shechter to give the answer. So if it's something that the Rav never said anything about, or you never heard the Rav talk about, so it may be appropriate for him to say, depending on the circumstance, the context, and what's understood implicit within the question, he should say, "I didn't hear this from the Rav." I don't know Rav Shechter's style well enough to say if he presumes that people are always asking about what the Rav says. I presume not. People are asking him what he has to say. But certainly, the Mishnah says, it goes without saying, you can't pass off something as something that someone else said. Okay, if somebody was asking Rabbi Akiva a question. He cannot say, "I learned this from Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yehoshua," unless he actually did. And if he's saying his own opinion, that should be clear. Al mashalo am shama, omer lo shamati. In other words, he's allowed to voice his own opinion, so long as it's understood that it is his own opinion. Okay? Which pertains again to what a person, not only what a person does with chachma, but how a person relates their chachma to the chachma of others. And finally, umodel ha'emet is certainly this, that sometimes two people are having an argument, and it may be the one is even generally considered a far greater authority than the other. One person may be a far greater authority than the other. If you have Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Ishmael, it's not up to me to say who's greater, but most of the time we consider Rabbi Akiva to be a greater authority, but it doesn't mean that just because he's a greater authority that he should always stand on ceremony and refuse to hear the words of the other. Bedavka, you have places where Rabbi Akiva and many other Chachamim say, "You know what, I heard the opinion of the other person, I've decided to adopt their opinion, I see that I was wrong." That's called Modal Ahmed. And it relates again, as I said, to Ezu Chacham Halamid Mikol Adam. We can say more. We learned in the first parak, we had the Mishnah of Shimon Beno, the son of Rabban Gamliel, and Shimon Beno Omer, Kol Yamai Gudalti Bein HaChachamim, V'lo Matzati Laguf tov elashtika, or lo matzati laguf tov mishtika. I didn't find anything better for the body than silence, or the only thing that I found good for the body was silence. But here, and it's interesting because he's talking about how he was raised bein hachachamim. He's talking about something that he learned from the chachamim. And being within the company, in the company of the Chachamim, he found that in that context, silence is specifically, explicitly, one of the most, or perhaps the most, or the only important tool, behavior, that one must employ. How does that relate to our Mishnah? Because again, as opposed to what we might consider a conventional, what most people will probably tell you is the conventional definition of wisdom, which is that it's a function of how much you've learned. Here, specifically, the Mishnah highlights understanding one's limits and specifically knowing how silence needs to be employed in the conversation of wisdom, in the evaluation of wisdom. When I'm having a discussion with others, oftentimes it's very important, necessary even, for me to keep my mouth closed, to know that the wisdom is, and the wisdom lies with someone else, and therefore I shouldn't speak. I shouldn't voice my own opinion. Or I should back away from my own opinion. Okay, let us move on.
Again, there are other Mishnayot here, which also other Mishnayot in the Masechet, which talk about Chachma, and those have to be seen side by side with this Mishnah as well. But I think a working definition of Chacham, and the one that this Mishnah specifically is trying to champion, the model of the Chacham that our Mishnah holds up as the great model, if I'm not mistaken, is somebody who knows how to wield Chachma, somebody who knows how to use Chachma. It's not simply a matter of having knowledge. How does a person, which is the person who best preserves and employs that wisdom? Okay, this is contrasted with the golem. What is a golem? So the word golem does not appear in many places at all in the Mishnah. In fact, I think it doesn't appear anywhere else in the Mishnah at all, but it does appear in other places in Chazal. Let's just do a quick search to see, to confirm that it doesn't appear other places in the Mishnah. What does the word golem mean? What does the word golem mean? So very often, actually, where the word golem appears in the writings of Chazal, it has the it's used in the following context. It is used to describe not people, but objects. What kind of objects? So specifically, sometimes we have this this usage of golmei clay eitz, for instance. Golmei clay eitz refers to raw materials of wood. Okay, and really, you could say how raw is actually a very important question. But the point is, it's something which is not quite finished. You might say, let's take the approach of many mefarshim over here, and they're trying to answer the following. They're trying to answer the question: what is a golem in the context of this Mishnah? So, in light of this usage of golmei clay eitz, for example, the mefarshim say, let's take the Rambam. The Rambam says, I don't know the word golem from elsewhere. In Avot, we have described some other people who are not the Chacham. There's somebody called an Am Haaretz, and there's somebody called a Boor. But I don't know where Golem fits on that continuum. Golem, Boor, Am Haaretz, Chacham, or is it Boor, Am Haaretz, Golem, Chacham? And the Rambam Bedavka says that the Golem is someone who is further along in his development, in his religious and intellectual development, than is the Boor and the Am Haaretz. And the Rambam uses the model of this golmei clay eitz. He says the golmei clay eitz are items which are just not quite ready for use. And actually, we have this when I was living in Boston. I was trying to work on a very low budget, and I needed to furnish my apartment, and I went to these unfinished wood stores. I think that probably most people who go to unfinished wood stores are looking for cheap furniture, but then they go home and finish the wood themselves. I, for whatever reason, didn't have so much motivation to do that, so I just had unfinished wood furniture in my apartment, but okay, the point is, unfinished wood is basically, when you go into an unfinished wood furniture store, it's basically furniture that's done. The only thing that it's missing is that the wood is not literally finished. That means it's not polished over with this special polish, which is called finish. It gives the wood a kind of a shine and protects it from water damage and other kinds of things. So basically it's done. It's just missing that last process. It's missing that last process. We have actually, I'm just looking at other Mishnayot. So the word golem appears in Shas Mishnayot in five places, and two are right here in our Mishnah. And the other three have to do with building materials. Golmei clay matachot in Masachet Ediot, and golmei clay matachot as well in Masachet Kelim and Perak Yud Bet, and later in Perak Yud Bet, golmei clay eights. Okay? Raw wood. So, therefore, the Rambam says, here we're talking about a person who has some refinements and has some wisdom, but they're missing that last step, which is, again, how to wield the wisdom. And that's what the Mishnah says. You can have somebody who's a real bona fide chacham, who's received the certificate of chachma, and that person is distinguished from the golem only because they have these last refinements. But the golem is really somebody who more or less has reached that level. They're just a little bit behind. And other mefarshim really follow suit and say more or less the same thing. I do want to point out one other usage of the word golem in Chazal, which is really remarkable. Now, again, without getting into anything having to do with the golem of Prague, because I won't say that it's irrelevant to our discussion, but it's only so relevant. I mean, that's a question in and of itself. The historical truth to the golem of Prague, did the Maharal make something called a golem, and what was it and what did it do, is not our topic at all. But even if you just want to say, oh, I know what a golem is because of the Maharal of Prague, so don't forget that the Maharal was more than 1200 years after the Mishnah, 1300 years. And therefore, just because he used the word golem in a certain sense doesn't necessarily mean that's what the Mishnah meant. However, this is not the only place in Chazal, that being said, this is not the only place in Chazal where the word golem is used in the context of humanity. And the other usage that Chazal have for the word golem is actually with respect to Avraham Avinu, Adam HaRishon, that in a few places, the Davka, in the Masechtot Ketanot, and Avot, and Rabbi Natan, and other places, so Chazal describe the hour by hour chronology of what happened on the sixth day of creation, and they talk about at what point how Hashem created man and what man did in his first hours of life, etc. And in that itemization, in that chronology, before Adam is completed and before Hashem breathes life into him, so man is described as a golem. He's a golem. Just before Hashem breathes life into him, he's this clod. You know, you have the image in your head, perhaps, of the Frankenstein monster, which is right a man ready to live but simply missing that spark, right? You're waiting for the heart to get started, but otherwise in all respects it's a man. And that I think is a slightly different understanding. It gives a different impression for what the word golem means. However, even if you take that approach, it helps us to understand perhaps a little better what the Mishnah is doing in our perek. In other words, once you talk about creation, let me tell you something about what man looks like at creation. That might be a bit of a stretch, but Chazal did use the word golem in that sense, and therefore, when you read, if this Mishnah here is using it in the same sense, then we can say the gap between a golem and a chacham seems to be profound. A golem is something of a pre-human. He's not quite a man yet, right? Perhaps even less than an Amaretz, less than a boor. Again, the Rambam certainly does not take this approach. The Mefarshim don't seem to take this approach. But that's the way the word golem is used. And in that case, if that's correct, even though the gap between golem and chacham is profound, but really what it boils down to is only the difference in these seven behaviors. And if a person behaves properly in these seven ways, then they can make themselves not just a person, but a chacham. I wanted to point out one more observation that I had here, and then we obviously need to move on to the next Mishnah. And that is the following. Let's say that the golem is a... Let's go back to the Rambam. Let's go back to the Rambam, the other Mefarshim. Let's say that the golem is somebody who's simply just pre-chachma. So what's extraordinary is the Rambam says, the golem may have a great deal of learning, and he may have a great deal of what we might call derech eretz. He has some cultivated behavior. He knows a little bit of etiquette, maybe a lot of etiquette. But because he violates these seven niceties, these seven appropriate behaviors, so he doesn't quite achieve his chacham status. If you think about this for a minute, it's really extraordinary. You have a person who has read a great deal, has learned a profound amount of Torah, and also does a lot of things properly, has a lot of ma'asim tovim, and knows how to treat his parents, and knows how to treat his spouse, etc. And all those things. And yet, they're not called a chacham, and the question is why? It's simply because they have failed to appropriately employ their chachma. They don't know how to properly discuss chachma. They don't know how to relate to others in the context of chachma. So isn't that amazing? That the person is called a golem. If we combine the two approaches that we said before, in light of the way that the Mefarshim read the word golem, but also in light of the way that Chazal employed the term golem with regards to Adam HaRishon, what this means is that the person is unfinished. And perhaps you could go as far as to say, the person is supposed to be a Chacham, but they're not considered a person yet. Why? This is a little bit more radical, but I think it's LP, let's say, following in the approach that's kind of advocated by the Baalei Musar. To achieve a lot in learning is an achievement. It means a person has to put in time. There's no question that you cannot. Learn without reading, right? Without hearing shiurim, without working on that. That's not something you can get by intuition. You're not going to just produce all of Masachet Kelim just by guessing, oh, this kli is tame, this kli is tahor. You have to learn the principles. So that's a lot of work. And yet, even with all that work, a person is not yet called a chacham. Meaning, perhaps, that the person doesn't have any credit. A person can have achieved a ton, and yet they're still, in the eyes of Chazal, or in the eyes of Hashem, maybe more radically, they're not anything more than a golem yet. They're still pre-man. Why? What is the golem? The golem is the form that Hashem has created. Okay, if a person is predisposed to be a bookish person, predisposed to studying, they love to read, they love to learn, they haven't done what they need to with their learning, so how much credit do they get with their learning simply because they've always followed their instinct? You wouldn't say that somebody who, if you took, let's say you take two fourth graders and you look at their math scores, so it's a little bit cruel the way the report card system works. But in the report card system, normally a person gets an A or 100 average or whatever it is if they get all the questions right on the test. So you can have a kid who's really, really, really good at math, comes to them super easy, doesn't study at all, skips all the homework. But they heard it once and they get it, they come to the test, they figure out the answers, and they walk away with 100. You have another kid who's trying hard, who does all the homework, spends a lot of time, has a tutor, studies like crazy, and fails all the math tests. And it's hard in schools. Schools don't have, as far as I know, I'm not aware of any school that really has a way to quantify the worth of the student who worked hard, and certainly not as being more valuable than the student who just gets it. But really, the student who tried harder is the better student, has done something worthier. Just because they haven't gotten the result, it's not really the most important thing. Certainly, it's not the only important thing in life. And again, I think Chazal would say it's not the most important thing from that child's perspective. So here, you may have somebody who's bookish, who has chachma, and who may have etiquette. They may have derech eretz, and yet they are not called a chacham. They're only called a golem. And the reason that they're only called a golem is that they haven't achieved anything on their own at all. They're really just the form, the clod, the unfinished product that Hashem created. Hashem created a person with a brain. So they don't get credit for having, they don't get so much credit for having read a ton, because that came totally natural to them. But when it came to work, when it came to refining their characteristics in terms of wielding this wisdom and knowing how to deal with wisdom, the person hasn't actually achieved that yet. He may still be called nothing more than a golem. And the point is that a person has to take what they have and then they have to employ it in a certain fashion. Just running with the things that come natural to them, that's not enough to consider a great achievement. Okay, we've spent an extraordinary amount of time on this and we need to move ahead. Mishnah Chet, the second list of sevens. Shiva minei puranuyot ba'in la'olam al shiva gufei avera. Miktzatan me'asrin, u'miktzatan enan me'asrin. Ra'av shel betzoret ba'a. Miktzatan re'evim, u'miktzatan sve'im. Number two, gamru shelo le'aser, ra'av shel mehuma v'shel betzoret ba'a. Number three, Vishalo Litola Tachala, Ra'av Shal Klayaba'a. Number four, Dever Ba'leolam, Al Mitot Ha'amurot, Batorah Shalo Nimsur Leveitin, Ve'al Perot Shvi'it. Number five, Cherev Ba'leolam, Al Inui Hadin, Ve'al Ivut Hadin, Ve'al Hamurim, Batorah Shalo Kehalacha. Number six, Chayara Abba Le'olam al Shivuat Shav ve'al Chilul Hashem. And number seven, Galut Ba Le'olam al Ovdei Avodah Zarah ve'al Gilui Areot ve'al Shvichut Damim ve'al Hashmatat Ta'aretz. Okay, now let's just translate what we've read. There are seven types of suffering that come into the world for seven bodies, seven super categories of sin. If some people give terumot and ma'asrot, tithes, and some do not give them, then there's ra'av shel batzoret, famine of scarcity. Famine of scarcity means that the resources are not there. There isn't enough rain, or there are other natural reasons for which the earth doesn't produce its expected yield. When you have famine of scarcity, therefore, some people are hungry and some are full. Okay, some people gave terumot and ma'asrot and some did not. And that's the punishment, is that some people will be full and some people will not. Number two, if they resolve not to give terumot and ma'asrot. Now we're not talking about lazy. We're talking about deciding to, as an act of rebellion, not to give terumot and ma'asrot. Then there's famine of mayhem and of scarcity. Okay, as the as some of the Mefarshim point out, Ra'av Shel Mehuma Mayhem may refer to war. Okay, it may refer to war. If they resolve not to give Tirmot to Ma'asrot, then the yield disappears for that reason and because of the scarcity, because simply the earth is not producing its yield. Number three, if they resolve not to take Chala, then there's famine of desolation, utter famine. Number four, disease comes into the world over the death penalties mentioned in the Torah, which are not given over to the court, and over the fruits of the sabbatical year. Okay, in other words, neglect of fruits of the sabbatical year, the fruits of Shemitah. Number five, violence comes to the world over the affliction of justice. Okay, Inui Hadin, which refers normally to when a court is trying a case and the person who's on trial has unnecessary delays in their trial. So that's considered a perversion or an affliction of justice, and that's not allowed. Okay? And over the corruption of justice, in other words, if people are if people are not given their proper verdict, if somebody is either condemned when they're supposed to be let off innocent, or let off innocent when they're supposed to be condemned, and specifically for reasons of corruption, of bribery, of favors, of all sorts of other things. And violence also comes to the world because of those who teach Torah in opposition to the halacha. Okay? Number six, harmful beasts come to the world over Shavuot Shav, vain oaths, and the desecration of Shem Hashem. And finally, exile comes to the world over those who commit Avodah Zara and Gilui Areot and Shvichut Damim, and then also because of Hashmatat Haaretz, the Shemitah of the land. Okay, we have a number of questions here. First of all, in the light of the last mission, I feel like it's very important to put them in their proper order. But for now, you'll excuse me if we just list them off as they come up. First of all, what does this mission have to do with the last mission other than the number seven? And I'm not sure that we're going to have an answer. I'm not sure that I have a good answer. Okay, it seems like really the only thread that connects this mission to the last is simply the number seven, because it takes a totally different approach. But Davka, I would say that this list of seven fits much better to the series of tens that we had before, because it talks about specific phenomena, and apparently specific phenomena that grow out of something, as the Mishnah says explicitly. Seven groups of suffering come to the world because of seven types of sin, seven bodies of sin. But that's a question, is what's it doing here? Another question is, what's the connection between these seven crimes and the seven punishments? The Mishnah doesn't tell us where it comes from, but if we can, we should try to figure out what's the connection. And there's, I think, it's worth trying to figure out what's so bad at some of these sins, because the punishments seem to be rather harsh. What is so bad about some people forgetting to give Trumot and Ma'asrot? Well, the truth is, you might say the punishment is not so bad, so it's not the biggest deal. But when you talk about Shemitah, what is so bad about neglecting Shemitah? What is so bad about neglecting the fruits of Shemitah, that disease should come into the world, that exile should come into the world? And that we will... We can think about it, and perhaps we'll have time to explore together. And finally, I think really the biggest question that needs to be asked here is this really fair? I mean, we can't argue with the Mishnah, so must be that it's fair. Chazal really saw it this way. But what are we supposed to do with this? That Chazal basically gave us a key to decoding natural and unnatural disaster. Chazal gave us a key to understanding crisis and disaster. And the question is, how literally are we supposed to take this? And what do I mean by that? Let's say there's a tsunami, God forbid, a destructive tsunami. You have a natural disaster somewhere in the Far East, okay? And unfortunately, we've had some of those. How about a hurricane? Right? If there's a hurricane that wipes out tons of property and many communities and leaves people homeless and etc., costs lives. So you just look at the Mishnah and say, that's it. You know, I know why it happened because of this. Is that appropriate to do? Is that fair to do? It really seems like that's what Chazal did. And on the one hand, there are people, you know, when natural disasters come about, there are people who are willing to get up and say, this happened because of X, Y, and Z. But then there are others who say, you know, we don't take the place of God. Who are we to take the place of God? And we can't just pass judgment in that sense. Is it passing judgment? Is that appropriate? I think the Mishnah really begs that question, and I want to spend a few minutes talking about that. So first of all, before we get into anything else, I think we have to remember that this question also came up in the second parak of the Masechet, in the story of Hillel. It's Parak Bet Mishnah Vav. Af hu ra'a gilgolet achat shatzafa al pnei hamayim. Amar la al di'ataft atfuch v'sof mitifich yitufun. Once Hillel saw a skull floating on the surface of the water. He said to it, since you drowned another, you have been drowned. And in the end, those who drowned you will also be drowned. So, therefore, it seems to be very well-founded. In other words, that's really what Hillel did. Hillel saw a skull, and he said to the skull, I know exactly what happened to you. You're a murderer. And since you murdered somebody, you've been murdered. But rest assured that he who murdered you will also be murdered. Is it really that simple? Can you just say that? Again, it's the same question. So, again, now you have two Mishnayot that seem to say you can say that, it's appropriate to say that. And Bedavka, the truth is I can even understand why it would be appropriate to say that. On the one hand, we don't want to judge people. On the other hand, if we don't understand that there's a cause to the suffering, then we may fall into the trap of saying, well, God is unjust. God is caprice. God is frivolous and whimsical. And there's really no reason for this person to suffer. And this person didn't deserve to suffer, but God made them suffer anyway, which is really heretical. It's heretical to say that, I believe, and it sounds heretical that, right? Ain't this really, Chazal described this as well. And then there were certain people who said, Ain din, but this is really actually Chazal in one place. So this is what happened to Elisha ben Avuya, that Elisha ben Avuya saw a terrible tragedy that happened to a certain person. And he said, Ein din ve'ein dayan. There's no justice and there's no judge. And that's why Elisha ben Avuya, who was one of the most outstanding Talmidei Chachamim of any generation, literally any generation, he left the fold of halachic practice, which is obviously very, very startling, very disturbing. So that was considered a heretical thing that he said. We don't say such a thing. So how do we approach this? Within this context, I think it's also appropriate to mention another couple of Gemaras, which are related directly and indirectly to our Mishnah. So first of all, so I just looked up about Elisha ben Avuya. I see that it wasn't Enodin Ve'en Dayan, but that's other people have said that, and that's also considered heretical. In any case, let's look at the Gemara in Sota. It appears also in Ketuvot, Daf Lamed Amud Aleph, Lamed Amud Bet. The Amar Rav Yosef, it's Sota Ched Amud Bet. The Amar Rav Yosef, V'chein Tani Rav Yechia, Miyom Shecharev Beit Mikdash, Afal Pisha Batla Sanhedri, Arba Mitzlot Lo Batlu. Daha Batlu. Ela Din Arba Mitzlot Lo Batlu. Mishenit Chayev Skila, Ono Fel Minagag, O Chayav Dor Asto. Mishenit Chayev Sreifa, Ono Fel Bidleka, Ono Chash Machisho. Mishenit Chayev Hariga, O Nimsar L'Malchut, O Listin Ba'in Alav. Mishenit Chayev Chanika, O Tavea Banahar, O Meit Bisaronchi. Okay, so the Gemara says over here that, in fact, from the day that the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, there's still such a thing as the four death penalties that the Torah describes. However, obviously the Beit Din is not administering these death penalties. Rather, through a seemingly natural way, really an unnatural way, Hashem brings about the person who is worthy of these death penalties will receive the death penalties. So again, it raises this question. Somebody receives these death penalties, and you see that happen, should you presume, is it fair, is it right to presume, to pass judgment and say, well, if a person died in this manner, it must be they were guilty of such a sin. The Mishnah, the Gemara here doesn't say this is the only way that these disasters will come about. Every single time a disaster befalls a person, it's because of one of the executions. However, it does say a person who needs to be executed will be as if, right, quote, they'll be executed in this way that God brings about their death. So the Mefarshim deal with this. The Mefarshim deal with this question: is it fair to say that the death penalty necessarily corresponds to a severe crime? I want to present here two approaches. One is that of Tosfot. And Tosfot asks this question on Sanhedrin Lamed Zayin Amud Bet. Tosfot says, wait a second, but we know there are many people who are profound heretics who don't die in any unusual way, and I presume that he means not just that they're heretics, that they also violate Shabbos and other Isurim through which they should be subject to various forms of death penalties, but they don't die in a particularly unusual way. So that would seem to be, Tosfot says, we see it with our own eyes, that this, what the Gemara says, is not true. Mechal Shabbos, or a murderer who dies a natural death, somebody who violates the Torah's laws of Gilui Arayot, of forbidden relationships, and yet such a person dies naturally. So how should we understand that? Tosfot says, V'yesh lomar t'zchut mila tola v'schar mitzvot she'asu mishtalmin ba'olam hazeh k'dichtiv u'mishalem lesonav. So Tosfot says, some people have the zchut of mila. So he doesn't answer the question for women. But for men, he says, unless he said the women also have that zchut, if they helped someone else, then help the man to get a mila. But basically, there are men who have the zchut, and at least they did a bris mila, and what the bris mila does is it protects them to this degree that they won't be subject to those death penalties, and Hashem will punish them rather in the world to come. But sometimes people have it good in this world because and this is based on Gemaras elsewhere, because Hashem doesn't withhold anybody's reward, anybody's just reward, and the question is the reward paid in this world or in the next world? However, the reward they certainly do receive, and therefore some people receive the reward in this world, but the punishment that they receive in the next world, as opposed to what the Gemara indicated elsewhere, again, which is that they should receive the death penalty. So Tosfot says that the bris milah may create, that the fact that they were circumcised may create this extenuating circumstance, may create a kind of a buffer, and the person dies a natural death only so that they can receive their just rewards, meaning their great punishment, in the next world. Therefore, some people get off. Tosfot doesn't fundamentally undo the question, but now that that's the case, and because, of course, when Tosfot was talking, for sure, who was a Jew who didn't have circumcision? Circumcision is so widespread that, and if it has the power to save people, then you really can't make any presumptions about anybody's justice at all. Now, the question is, does this only apply to circumcision, or can it be applied to other things as well? But even if it can't, Tosfot has already given us at least the solution for the men. Okay, Tosfot Yom Tov. Interestingly, this is a student of the Maharal. Tosfot Yom Tov asks the question on the Mishnah, on Hillel's Mishnah in Perek Bet. And it's worth seeing inside, but I just want to present the crux of what he says. He says, what Hillel says is very nice, but and Hillel said it, but the reality doesn't fit this. In other words, we know, if you open your eyes, Tosfot Yom Tov says, we know there are many people who commit murders, and they don't get murdered afterwards. And there are people who are murdered, even though they themselves have never committed a murder. So you can't just see a skull floating in the water and say, you can't see a murder victim and say, you got this because you have committed murder. It's an oversimplification, he says. And in theory, the same question could be asked in our Mishnah. And he gives the following answer. He says that when Hillel spoke in the second parak, when he was talking to the skull, talking of the skull, it's only on speculation. And he said that this is really the way that things should work, and this may be the way that things did work. It may really truly be that you were murdered because you murdered someone else, and this is what you deserve. However, he couldn't say it with certainty, and he didn't say it with certainty. He said it to a particular skull. But when he was talking to the masses, and when he was giving the general principle, giving hard iron principles, ironclad principles to everyone, he would describe things, Tosfot Yom Tov says, in a more general sense, murder begets murder. That kind of approach. But right, you can't say 100%, because and he brings a powerful proof from the verse in Yeshayahu, Lo machshavotai machshavotechem, but lo darchichem durachai. My ways are not your ways, my thoughts are not your thoughts, Hashem says. And therefore, just because it looks like something doesn't necessarily mean that you can really say 100%. And when it comes to divine justice, there's so many different factors to consider that Hashem knows how everything is supposed to be handled, but we do not. So just because we know that Hashem did the right thing doesn't necessarily mean we can retrace all of the steps. Sometimes a person has whatever mitigating circumstances that require them, very often they have mitigating circumstances that require their own specific kind of justice. It's not the kind of thing that we could have simply reconstructed on our own. We should mention within this context also the comments of Rashi on that story of Hillel, that according to Rashi, Hillel only said it because he knew specifically whose skull it was. He knew the circumstances of that case, but he couldn't necessarily have made that generalization about every skull. Why is this important? Why then, if Hillel couldn't have said it as a general rule, why did the Mishnah present it as a general rule? So again, come back to Tosfot Yom Tov, who says that as a general rule, this is how things work. Divine justice is measure for a measure, and it makes sense that a person is subjected to murder if they themselves have committed, if he himself has committed murder. But it doesn't necessarily mean that you, as a one person, can retrace everything and put it together in that way, to look at God's justice and say, this is how it worked. Okay. Coming back to our Mishnah, I would like to point out that there's a difference between Hillel's case and our Mishnah, which is that our Mishnah is talking about globally, and I think the question is much stronger if you're talking about Hillel's case, because if you're talking about an individual, it's much harder to know what happens to the individual. However, the Torah says, and here the best example is probably the second parak of Shema. The Torah says already explicitly that if the masses, if people as a community are serving Hashem b'chol levav v'chem v'chol nafshechem, then v'natatim utar atzachem b'yito yorhel makosh v'yasavta deganecha p'tiroshcha v'yitzarecha. Then if we are serving Hashem with all of our hearts and all of our souls as a nation, then Hashem provides ample, bountiful rain. Then the earth produces its yield in a healthy and plentiful manner. And that's not the case if, God forbid, we are committing massive sin. Then there's massive punishment, widespread. And that's what the Mishnah talks about. There is such a thing as collective responsibility, communal responsibility. It doesn't mean I'm getting punished for what someone else did that I had nothing to do with. But the whole point, and the Mishnah, I think, says this very, very cleanly, the Mishnah says, Miktzatan mehasrin, umiktzatan ein mehasrin, which makes it sound like it's really laissez-faire. There's nothing in place that encourages everybody. There's no system by which everybody gives maaser. Therefore, okay, there will be some plenty and there will be some scarcity. By the way, who gets the plenty and who gets the scarcity? It's interesting. The Mishnah doesn't say, for those who give, they will receive bounty, and for those who don't, they will suffer. Though Chazal did indicate that elsewhere, but as being a little bit more of a personal kind of fate. But here the Mishnah again leaves it in pretty much global terms, that the community will be subject to scarcity, and if there's scarcity for some in the community, that really affects everyone to some degree or another. Now, and that's as opposed to if gamru shelo le'aser, then that's right. That's a widespread conspiracy where everybody decides not to give the tithes. Then there's a punishment which is more comprehensive, that covers, is wide, more widespread, and affects more people, because there's ra'av shel mehuma, famine of mayhem, and famine of scarcity, which strains the resources even more. Let us make another point here, and then we'll just wrap up. The last point I want to make over here is that even though the consequences of the Mishnah, it's hard to link the consequences to the crimes. Chazal did this in other places, because each of these things is based on specific verses from the Torah. So the Torah declares that this is the way it's supposed to be. There is a principle behind it, which is that, and this is a little bit easier to see with regards to the agricultural mitzvahs, Hashem gives us certain agricultural blessings, and provides us with conditions of blessing with the presumption or with the trust, with the opportunity that we will use those blessings positively, that we will use those blessings to do mitzvot. But if we don't do those mitzvot, then we're not entitled to the blessings. And that's simply the way it is. In other words, he gives us bountiful fruit and vegetable in order that we have enough to provide for the poor. And if we don't do that, then Hashem says, so to speak, there's no need for me to give you so much fruit and vegetable. You don't care about the plight of others, and the suffering of others enough to take care of them and separate the Trumot and Ma'asrot. So I don't need to give you such bountiful fruit and vegetable. You can struggle for it a little bit more yourself instead of me making it so easy for you. The Shemitah is a similar thing, though some aspects of Shemitah relate to Bein Adam L'Chaveiro and some relate to Bein Adam L'Makom. There you could say something similar, that with regards to whatever it is that we're supposed to learn from Shemitah, if you don't learn those things about Hashem's control over the earth, and the fact that the land belongs to Hashem, which is one of the lessons of the Shemitah, we're supposed to take a step back and recognize that it's really Hashem who is the proprietor of the world. If we don't recognize that, then he says to us, in the words of the Mishnah, then we go to Galut, okay? The earth, the land of Israel, which is the only place where Shemitah needs to be observed, the land of Israel was given to you so that you should live a certain kind of a lifestyle and understand certain kinds of things in light of the mitzvahs, one of them being this principle of Shemitah, which is that the earth belongs to God, and the land of Israel belongs to God. And if you don't recognize that in a concrete way, you don't put that into action, then God says you don't deserve to live in the land of Israel. Okay, I want to just finish up the Mishnah over here, Mishnah Tet. And this is a transition to the next series, which we'll get to next time. But it's also kind of a footnote, an appendix to the Mishnah we just learned. There are seven, as we said, seven bodies of Aveira, of sin, that bring about seven manners of suffering. And as a closely related corollary, the Mishnah says the following: Be'arba'a prakim hadever mitrabe, disease increases at four junctures, regularly. Baravi'it, uvashvi'it, uvmotza'e shvi'it, uvmotza'e hachag. In the fourth year of the Shemitah cycle, in the seventh year of the Shemitah cycle, and after the seventh year, after the Shemitah year, okay, motza'e shvi'it, and uvmotza'e hachag, shavachol shana v'shana. Every year after Sukkot, then disease also increases. And the Mishnah tells you why. Barvi'it mipnei ma'aser anisha b'shlishit. In the fourth year, it increases because of neglect of the tithe that's given to the poor in the third year. Bashvi'it mipnei ma'aser anisha b'shishit. On the Shemitah year, there's more disease because people have neglected the tithe to the poor in the sixth year. Motza'e shvi'it, the year after the Shemitah year, there's more disease because mipnei peirot shvi'it, because of the neglect and desecration of the fruits of the Shemitah year. Uvmotza'e hachag, shebachol shana v'shana, and every year after Sukkot, mipnei gezel matnot aniyim, because of the theft of other gifts that have to be given to the poor over the course of the year. That Sukkot is really the end of the harvest season, and it's when those things, those outstanding debts, needed to have been paid off. If they're not paid off, then it becomes time for the punishment already, and the punishment is disease, as has been indicated already in the previous Mishnah. This little clause over here does raise a few more questions, but unfortunately, I think we are out of time. And if you look, there's a little bit of relate to that a little bit in the accompanying source sheet. But the rest I'd leave you to reflect upon and study further. Okay, next time, God willing, we'll move into the section of the fours.